Good morning. It's Monday, April 22nd, Earth Day. The war in the Middle East is now 199 days old. I'm Jonathan Schanzer, Senior Vice President for Research at Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Welcome back to the FDD Morning Brief. First, a special thanks to my colleagues, Jonathan Conricus and Enya Cravine, for hosting over the last week and a half while I was overseas. I traveled to Greece, Cyprus, and Israel during that time. I'll share some of my observations about my travels shortly, but wow, what a time to be in Israel just days after that massive Iranian drone and missile attack. And I left just one day before that surgical Israeli response. Fascinating and exciting as it all was, I'm pleased to be back here in the saddle at the FDD Morning Brief. So please do keep tuning in. Our guest this morning is Behnam Ben Talablu. As you may recall from his previous appearance here, he's a senior fellow at FDD focusing on Iran. And luckily for us, he focuses some of his considerable brain power on the rockets, missiles, and drones wielded by the Islamic Republic. We'll talk to him shortly about what Iran deployed and also what we saw the Israelis flash in response. Behnam will be joining us live on the FDD Morning Brief. On the night of April 13th, I was at a restaurant with a senior Greek diplomat, a longtime friend. The conversation was brutal. I was getting an earful about Israel's war in Gaza. The pictures from Gaza were too much to bear, I was told. Yes, Hamas was responsible, but Israel had the power to stop this nightmare, I was told. My friend implored me to convey this to the Israeli officials I would meet later that week. Then the phone rang, and I watched my friend's eyes go wide. Iran had just launched a massive volley of drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles at Israel. The conversation took a 180-degree turn. Forget what I said before, I was told. Tell our friends in Israel that Greece stands with them. I tell you this not because Greece is a great friend of Israel. Of course it is. No, I tell you this because the game has changed. As much as Israel needs to finish off Hamas in Gaza, that's now small fries, folks. The war with Iran has come out of the shadows. It's a new war now, and Israel has no choice but to win it. But what is Israel's strategy? That remains to be seen. America and Europe helped to defend Israel by intercepting roughly 25% of the Iranian missiles and drones the other night. But what will their role be from here? These are key questions, and will be answered in due course. But just so we're all on the same page, we've just entered into the next phase of the 10-7 wars. Now for your headlines. Headline one, the Israeli strike on that military base in Isfahan on Friday is still generating a lot of buzz. Here's what we know. The weapon used was a glide bomb of sorts, a standoff weapon that did not trigger warnings from Iran's missile defense systems. Those are Russian systems, by the way. And the target was a radar that protects some of Iran's most sensitive nuclear sites. In other words, Israel not so subtly informed the clerical regime that it can do some serious damage to Iran if it's forced to. I might even take it a step further and say that this was a glimpse of what Israel would do in phase one of a wider operation if Iran crosses the nuclear threshold. So what was accomplished? I'm glad you asked. First, I think it might deter Iran from firing more missiles and drones at Israel for a while. I know for a fact this was what the Israelis were trying to achieve with their kinetic message. But here's my problem. The regime is clearly not deterred from deploying its proxies after this. Hezbollah, the Houthis, and all the other thugs for hire are still at it. So the Israelis still have some hard choices to make if they are to win this war. Headline two, the House of Representatives approved $95 billion in foreign aid for Ukraine, Israel, and other American allies in a rare weekend session. This is obviously good news, both for Ukraine and Israel, and it's good news for American national security. The move also comes amidst the change in tone from the U.S. and the U.K., who are now no longer berating Israel, but rather urging Israel to return to the fight in Gaza. This is because they don't want the Israelis turning their sights on Iran. I know the Israelis welcome this, but the strategic confusion here is profound. As I've already said, the Gaza war is small fries, or kesef katan, as the Israelis would say. Finishing off Hamas must not be viewed as a major strategic victory. Seriously, like serious conversations with the United States and other allies are now urgently needed about the trajectory of this war against the Islamic Republic. And before you get too excited about a return to relative sanity, sanctions are coming against the IDF. You heard that right. The Biden administration is set to sanction the IDF's Netzach Yehuda battalion. As I understand it, the battalion was involved in the mistreatment of Palestinians back in 2022. The Israeli government moved them out of the West Bank to deal with the problem in 2022. But no significant punishment was handed down. So now, 2 years later, the United States is taking steps to do exactly that, as if this is the job of the United States government. It's probably clear to everyone, but allow me to say so anyway. This is bananas. The United States is sanctioning the People's Army of Israel during a war that they didn't start and that has now been funded and funded again by the United States. The president's attempts to appease the progressive left while also fulfilling the national security needs of our country strikes me as totally incoherent, if not bipolar. For this reason, among others, I cannot wait for this election season to end. There are some other headlines we haven't covered today, like the jarring events at the anti-Semitic cesspool known as Columbia University, and the announcement by the biggest Iran-backed militia in Iraq, Kataib Hezbollah, that attacks on the U.S. are set to resume. We'll touch on both, I'm sure, in episodes to come, as well as other headlines. In the meantime, I am pleased to introduce Behnam Ben Talablu, otherwise known as the Notorious BBT. He was one of my first hires at FTD, and that was one of the best decisions I've made. Behnam has gone on to become one of Washington's top Iran analysts, and I'm particularly proud to note that he is an Iranian-American who is fighting for a better future in both countries. Oh, and Behnam is a wizard when it comes to Iranian rockets, missiles, and drones, so we've invited him back here to the show to chat live right now on the FTD Morning Brief. Welcome, Behnam Ben Talablu.
John, thank you so much. It's a pleasure and an honor to be back with you.
Great to have you. Okay, let's start things off with the attack of April 13th. What did the Iranians send at Israel? How many different variants did you track, and how do you interpret what they sent?
Well, it's very interesting because to date, the regime in Iran has not actually said what they have fired. The best way we can know what they fired is the imagery that some social media outlets in Iran, some individuals, and also some government linked media outlets have put out. There's three classes of projectiles that we know the regime has fired. One are one-way drones or suicide drones or kamikaze drones. These are the Delta Wing kind of low and slow flying aircraft, unmanned aircraft, like the Shahid 131 and 136. There are pictures and videos of this. Then there's things that fly a bit faster, but also still low and slow flying. And these are cruise missiles, particularly land attack cruise missiles. The variant that we see is the Pave. The Pave is basically one of the cruise missiles that Iran had first developed for the Houthis in Yemen under the brand of the Quds cruise missile. The Houthis have at least four different versions of this. You see with this smaller turbojet, if I'm not mistaken, on the bottom. This has static wings. This was also revealed in the Iranian press. And the one that the press has poured the most kind of secrecy over is the classes of ballistic missiles they fired at Israel. This is a game-changing strike, not only because it's the first ever missile-to-missile, territory-to-territory operation by Iran against Israel, but it's the first time ever the regime in Iran ever engaged in a ballistic missile operation against a defended target. All 12 that I covered in my monograph before have been against undefended targets, Syria, Iraq, Pakistan. And the classes of missiles they employed are twofold, both solid and liquid propellant. The solid propellant is, we believe, to be one of the newer versions of a upgraded Fatah to medium range. This is the Khaybar Shekem. This was used in January 2024 against a target in Syria. And then two classes of liquid propellant medium range ballistic missiles, the Emad, which has a maneuverable warhead, and the Qadr, which has a triconic warhead.
Well, we've learned a lot about what was fired. I mean, there were 320 different missiles, drones, and cruise missiles that were fired, from what we understand, carrying something like 60,000 tons of explosives, from what I've heard. That sounds insane to me. Then there's the part that I think has also gone uncovered, which is the pilots that were in the air. And we're talking about the British pilots, the Israeli pilots, I guess also maybe some Jordanian ones, from what we understand. The process of tracking these drones and cruise missiles, the low flying, slow flying stuff, is incredibly challenging from what I understand for pilots to lock on because they're much more used to flying fast and flying at higher altitudes. So it was interesting to hear about some of that during my travels. But let me ask you specifically about those ballistic missiles, because I think that's the story that maybe isn't covered enough here. These are the ones that are as long as a bus, and we've seen the photos, we've seen the video, but there are some nuclear implications here, aren't there, Behnam?
Yeah, this is the quiet part out loud, and really one would think the regime would be covering this a bit more because they call every single medium-range ballistic missile that they have produced a separate class. They call them Israel-hitting missiles, so they're quite literally telegraphing you what they would like to do with it. Just for the audience, a medium-range ballistic missile is one that can travel at least over 1,000 kilometers and under 3,000 kilometers. You know, the smallest point-to-point distance is about 900-plus kilometers between Iran and Israel. The smallest kind of base-to-point distance is about 1,400 kilometers. These projectiles fly 1,450 kilometers and on. And here's that quiet part out loud. Most of the warheads from the classes of these medium-range ballistic missiles were designed to deliver nuclear payloads. So if you look at what the stated warhead capability, you know, 500 kilograms, and at least the range, at least over 300 kilometers, these surpass the, you know, baseline strategic system thresholds of the missile technology control regime. So that's just a fancy way of saying all of Iran's medium-range ballistic missiles can indeed be retrofitted to carry a nuclear warhead. And the ones that have a smaller conical warhead, well, guess what? There's always a smaller bomb. So in this instance, this may have been a dry run or a test or some kind of signal, political signal by the Iranians. Just because there's conventional payloads coming at you today doesn't mean there won't be nuclear payloads coming at you tomorrow.
And this all comes, I saw this morning that Iran's foreign minister somehow reiterated again that Iran's not interested in developing nukes, but yet here we are looking at potential dry runs, the mixed messaging coming out of the Islamic Republic. You know, it ends up being sort of a Rorschach test, right? The West gets to interpret things for whatever it is that they think they want to interpret for their own policy. And well, that'll be one to watch. I want to ask you about the Israeli response, right? Took a couple of days and then the Israelis did fire back. And we know that they hit a radar in the Isfahan region, and we know that there are nuclear facilities in that region that are valuable to the regime. A message was clearly sent. What do you think the Israelis fired? What's your best guess at what that munition was? And what was the message in particular? I mean, how do you think that the regime interpreted that strike?
Well, before we get into the guesswork, which actually still exists over the exact type of munition the Israelis used, let's not forget the historic nature of the Israeli strike. The fact that Israel had telegraphed in advance of the Iranian strike, if you strike Iranian territory, we will strike. If you strike Israeli territory, we will strike Iranian territory. So everyone knew a response was coming. It was just a matter of when, not if. So that itself was historic. The next thing, of course, was the date of the strike in the early morning of April 19. Let's not forget, April 19 is Iran's supreme leader's birthday. He turned 85 that day, so that was a nice bit of poetic justice and political symbolism there. In the first, I would say, 10 hours after the press had been reporting the strike, I was greatly of the mind that this was a quadcopter drone, particularly given the fact that the two other times that you had these, you know, explosions at military facilities, the Israelis, assumedly, had been able to do it by quadcopter drone. And there is no secret, even Iranian officials say this, that Israel has punctured much of the security services, the intelligence services. Before COVID, you had a former intelligence minister saying no Iranian officials should sleep safely at night. That was when there was a string of assassinations and sabotage and cyber attacks and things that would go bump in the night. So because the Israelis had used a quadcopter drone so successfully against military facilities twice before, 2022 and 2023, it stood to logic that something low and slow flying under the radar could have struck this base. But once you got a bit more distance and a little bit more braggadocio by Israel in the, you know, social media world and in the press, it seemed like this was an aerial operation. And indeed, Jerusalem Post and ABC had confirmed that this was an aerial operation. Then the question became, did the aircraft penetrate Iranian airspace, or strategically operate from range to engage in what military folks call a suppression of enemy air defense operation or a destruction of enemy air defense operation. And you mentioned glide bomb. That's totally one possibility. This is very much looking like Israeli technical superiority over Iranian technical superiority. So if the Iranians had within the surprise of their volleys ballistic, this was the Israelis showcasing a different kind of ballistic. This is most likely, in my view, an air-launched ballistic missile. So a fighter jet can drop it, and then from there, as far out as their jet wants to go and still be safe, that ballistic missile can, you know, basically launch and maneuver, which is likely how it went around the existing patchwork of air defenses, and strike one of those three critical radar installations for the S-300.
Well, I think we'll all continue to track this. I did hear from someone within the system that it was something akin to a glide bomb, but I guess we'll have to learn over time exactly what that was.
Let me just ask you this. We should watch this in Russia as well. The Russian ability to operate from range against existing Ukrainian air and missile defenses is brought to by the ability of their jets to carry glide bombs. So in some ways, we're seeing the regions copy and learn from one another on both the Israeli and the Iranian side and on the Russian and the Ukrainian side.
Well, so let me ask you this. I mean, do you like the Israeli response? Do you think that it helped to deliver a message and reestablish deterrence? I mean, you're a Farsi speaker. So, I mean, how has the regime framed this in the Iranian media? Can you get a sense that they've been chastened by this exchange?
You can really tell they've been chastened because they've tried to stress normalcy. You know, within the hours, it was about 5, 6, 7 a.m. when the Iranian television stations were coming online because it was in the wee hours of the morning that the strike was reported. They tried so hard to stress the normal nature of things on a Friday morning in Isfahan province. They even showed static pictures of squares. They had, you know, the press talk about all is well. There would be no need to keep saying all is well if all was not well in reality. The issue was barely mentioned in Friday prayer sermons that day, about a couple hours after. By Saturday, so by the weekend, you had Iranian military officials not even really mention it and go back to the chest thumping of their own military strike against Israel. So the desire to minimize this is so significant, A, because the regime really got hit in a place that it did not expect and in a manner it did not expect. So one really does applaud the creativity and the escalation control and the targeting superiority of the Israelis, which beyond what the Iranians had done when they, you know, Mark and I had written in an op-ed last week that the Iranians have painted a target on their back by engaging in an overt conventional operation against the Israelis. But the Israelis have shown that they can respond against this in a still controlled but very militarily and politically significant way. And this, for the future of our policy deliberations, does not mean military option, yes or no. It means military options, how and where. And the ability of the Israelis to technically change the parameters of this discussion is going to lead to a lot more creative policy thinking against Iran's nuclear, missile, military, drone, and other programs in the future.
You think you're right, but let me maybe ask you one last question here. The Israelis clearly sent a message. The Iranians clearly received it, but it hasn't changed the game from what I can tell, right? If this may halt Iran's thinking about possible future strikes of ballistic missiles and cruise missiles or drones out of Iran directly, right? That was the message, is don't do this again. And the Israelis responded under the threshold of escalation. So they checked the box with the United States. And in other words, this was a very specific message for a very specific activity within the parameters of what the U.S. was willing to allow. So what do you think the Iranian strategy will be from here? I mean, will we see more of the same ring of fire activity from the proxies? We have heard already this morning that Kataib Hezbollah says it's back in action. And Hezbollah in Lebanon is still firing on a regular basis against Israel. And I mean, we can see that the broader strategy hasn't changed. And then I think there's the other question, which, you know, Mark and others have been talking about, which is, you know, what about the Iranians' other plans? And I'm talking about the nuclear file. How do you assess where we go from here?
Well, I still think in terms of the regional dynamic, the Iranians believe that things are going their way. That's a dangerous dynamic to have. That's a dangerous perception to have. But at least the Israelis with the strike showed that there is a cap. And that if you reach too far, you will absolutely be slapped down. And you will be slapped down in a manner that does not put distance between Israel and its most important international partner, and shows you how much more we can do with less. So that was really the magic, the secret sauce of the Israeli response. It doesn't mean peace is breaking out in the Middle East. It does mean for the short to medium term, maybe Israel will be able to focus on Rafah, focus on Hamas. But that, as you mentioned in the lead, is going to be very much a tactical issue, not a strategic issue. The Ring of Fire is still in place. The government of the Islamic Republic continues to chant death to Israel. The Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps continues to be forward deployed. There still is the proliferation of capabilities to these proxies. There is the domestic production of long-range strike capabilities in the hands of most of them. The bad trend lines are still continuing, so we are nowhere out of the conflict zone yet. And just on the nuclear file, the only irony here is, oh, there's two. One is that publicly, the regime has since 2018 been having a string of officials come out saying, don't push us, something may happen. You know, most recently, you had an IRGC official in charge of security for the nuclear facilities say that we may revisit our nuclear doctrine. And the Iranians are counting on two things here. One, the restraint of the Biden administration and, in general, American desire to leave the region to control or limit Israeli kinetic action against Iran. And two, the ability of the regime to weaponize nuclear blackmail. And this is something they've done very well. And ironically, the more successful Israel and America may be against Iran's conventional deterrence, you may see the regime panic and try to double down and wave that nuclear sword of Damocles.
Tend to agree. Hate to leave it there, but I think that's where we're going to leave it. Thank you, Behnam Bentaloglu, for joining us live today on the FTD Morning Brief.
Thank you.
Here's what FTD has on tap for you today. This weekend, FTD Chief Executive Mark Dubowitz was featured in a lengthy Wall Street Journal interview with Elliot Kaufman. The two discussed Iran's war on Israel, how fast the regime could sprint to a bomb, and what the U.S. and Israel can do to support the brave women and men of Iran. It's well worth a read. FTD Action is closely tracking those national security bills that passed in the House of Representatives over the weekend. This included over $26 billion for Israel, nearly $61 billion for Ukraine, and $8 billion for the Indo-Pacific, not to mention other big things like the forced sale of TikTok and a crackdown on fentanyl traffickers. FTD Action will be all over this as the legislative package moves to the Senate. And finally, FTD's Royal Mark Erect and CFR's Ray Takei published yet another piece in the Wall Street Journal that you'll want to read. They explore Iran's nuclear calculus and why the West shouldn't underestimate the ailing Ayatollah's need for a nuclear legacy. That's it for today. Read our expert analysis on our website, FTD.org. Read our quick takes on X at FTD and support our work, as always, with a tax-deductible donation at FTD.org/invest. Tune in Wednesday for another episode of the FTD Morning Brief. We'll continue to analyze the dramatic developments out of the Middle East, and I'll tell you more about my recent travels. Oh, and a happy Passover for those who celebrate. I'm Jonathan Shanzer, signing off for FTD.